see many of you here again.
A lot has happened since we met here in February, and I hope that those of you who have done so have enjoyed reading the fruits of our labours. Can I first of all thank Fiona and her team for hosting us this morning, as she did in February. Thank you very much for going to so much trouble. And then just briefly, to recap on who we are, you've got biographical notes in the report, but as you've heard, I'm Muir Russell. I'm before my retirement last autumn, I was the VC at the University of Glasgow, and before that I was the permanent secretary to the Scottish Executive. On my right, Jim Norton, who brings experience as a senior manager and advisor in the fields of information policy and IT security, including roles advising Parliament through the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology. On my left, Geoffrey Burton, who was Regius Professor of Geology at the University of Edinburgh, with a research background in the fields of glaciology, glacial geology, quaternary science, and energy. And then Peter Clark, who is the Professor of Physics at the University of Edinburgh. He was, until recently, the Director of the National eScience Centre and is now working at CERN. And David Eyton, who is abroad and can't be with us today, is Group Head of Research and Technology at BP. He sits on the UK Energy Technologies Institute Board and the Science Business Innovation Board. And I really just want at the start to thank the team for putting into this what has been a huge amount of effort into our evidence gathering and analysis and report writing. What we have is a substantial product, and I hope you will have seen that it addresses the issues with care on the basis of sound evidence. And I want to begin with a few words about the way in which we approach the task. First, this was not about forming a view on the content or the quality of the scientific work and the conclusions drawn by CRU. Let me explain that. We looked at processes and procedures and how data was handled, but not at how the results should be interpreted in scientific terms. Our job was to look at the behaviour of the crew scientists. We examined their honesty, rigour and openness in relation to the allegations made against them. And under the word honesty, a particular concern would be about setting out to arrive at a predetermined outcome or suppressing contrary views. And we were also concerned with the frankness of communication. We didn't set out to perform a close textual analysis on the emails, parsing every sentence and looking up every word in the dictionary. That would have taken forever. Some would have been happy that it should have taken forever. But it would have got us nowhere, not least because they do not all point in the same direction. We've not sought to explore what some of the widely quoted phrases mean, either in substance or in intent. Instead, we used our reading of the emails and our understanding of the issues they raised for those engaged in the climate debate to try to get at the key allegations about the behaviour of the crew scientists. And we sought to test those allegations with objective evidence so far as possible. Now, we didn't go for the courtroom style of inquiry with oral testimony and cross-examination. Instead, we gave critics the chance to make detailed submissions setting out their challenge to the crew scientists, and we gave crew the chance to answer by pointing to objective evidence that they wanted to bring forward. Because ultimately, this has to be about what they did, not what they said. And the results are there for you all to see and to judge in our report and on our website. Now, we wanted to give a sense of perspective to all this, so we used the approach that's set out in paragraph 10 of the executive summary. On handling global temperature data, we went to global primary sources and we tested how data was handled. On tree ring temperature reconstructions, we looked at the overall picture painted in Chapter 6 of the Fourth Assessment Report of the IPCC in 2007, and we examined the influence of crew. On peer review, we sought independent input from the editor of The Lancet on how the system works to provide a context for our judgment. On influencing the IPCC process, we sought advice from the review editor on the role contributors can play. I believe that this has given authority to our conclusions, and it should stop in their tracks those who have made up their minds that this is a whitewash, without waiting to see what we've done. So what have we concluded? First, climate science is a matter of such global importance that the highest standards of honesty, rigour and openness are needed in its conduct. On the specific allegations made against the behaviour of crew scientists, we find that their rigour and honesty as scientists are not in doubt. In addition, we do not find that their behaviour has prejudiced the balance of advice given to policymakers. In particular, we did not find any evidence of behaviour that might undermine the conclusions of the IPCC assessments, and I'll come back to the question of public interest in openness a little later. But we do find that there's been a consistent pattern of failing to display the proper degree of openness, both on the part of the crew scientists and on the part of the UEA, who failed to recognise not only the significance of statutory requirements, but also the risk to the reputation of the university and indeed to the credibility of UK climate science. Now let's look at the detail of why we reached those conclusions, and the first two points I'm going to make relate to crew's core science, temperature data and work on tree ring reconstructions. First, about the temperature series, there was the allegation that crew must have something to hide, and so their work could in some way not be trusted because they were withholding, concealing or manipulating data. So what we did was to get hold of the data from publicly accessible sources ourselves and to analyse it without any reference at all to crew to see whether one could produce the sort of results they'd been producing, a simple trial analysis. And we got essentially the same shapes of graph as you'll see in the report. We concluded that whether or not you use data with or without the modifications or adjustments crew used, or even if you select just subsections of the data, the outcome is robust. Now, how that outcome is interpreted is, of course, a proper matter for scientific debate. But we conclude the argument that crew has something to hide does not stand up. What our work also suggests is that anyone who wants to can do their own analysis. The data is publicly available, the code is so easy to write, and testing alternative hypotheses is therefore not difficult. That's our first key set of findings. Secondly, there were allegations that the work on tree rings, reconstructing temperature proxy records, also proceeded on the basis of selection of data in order to produce a predetermined outcome. There is, of course, a lot of proper scientific debate about what conclusions can be drawn from tree rings and with what uncertainty. But looking at crew's publications, we do not see any evidence that they were actively selecting tree series to produce a predetermined outcome. And our key high-level point here is that when you look at how the crew work fed into the overall judgment about climate history, made on the basis of Figure 610 in Chapter 6 of the relevant IPCC report, and you'll find that in our Chapter 7, you find it did not invalidate the overall picture painted. So we do not find that the question marks placed by the allegations over the crew scientists' input make the IPCC report judgment misleading. We have some comments to make on the expression of uncertainty in relation to that judgment, where we feel that the approach taken by IPCC was an improvement on earlier reports. Now, these are the parts of our report that provide the basis for our conclusion that the honesty and rigour of crew as scientists are not in doubt, and that we've not found any evidence of behaviour that might undermine the IPCC processes and hence call into question the conclusions of the IPCC assessments in those areas. Let me now turn to the allegations about peer review. There was a lot of concern, for example, on the part of the Commons Committee on Science and Technology, that we should address those issues fully. And you will find in the report a paper written by Richard Horton of The Lancet, with comments from Liz Wager, who is the chair of the Committee on Publication Ethics. This critique of peer review helps to set in context the allegations made about the behaviour of crew scientists in response to contested papers. As you will see, we analyse the specific allegations made and find that the sort of robust positions crew scientists took were typical of the debate that can go on during peer review. Peer review is indispensable, but some myths about peer review need to be addressed. We believe that this work will make a significant contribution to wider understanding and debate on peer review. Now, Richard Horton is here, and he'll be prepared to deal with any questions that you have for him when this press conference is over. The fourth set of allegations related to the part crew played in the drafting of chapters 3 and 6 of the IPCC report. We had a lot of evidence here on both sides of the argument. It's a lengthy chapter, but what is clear to us, and crucially we went to the review editors to verify this, is that Professors Jones and Briffa were part of teams of authors and were not in a position individually to determine the final wording of and content of the chapters. So, can I now move on to the question of the degree of openness in crew's behaviour? And we have significant criticisms to make there. Firstly, the withholding of data, there seems no doubt that crew got themselves into a position that they were unhelpful in response to legitimate requests. And there were plenty of references to anxiety about what critics would use the data for. We address very directly the question of compliance with the Freedom of Information Act, where we find evidence of unhelpfulness in responding to requests, and we make a number of recommendations about the way in which UEA should respond to this. In particular, there needs to be engagement right up to senior management, supporting the proper handling of information requests, and recognition in the risk management process of the potential for damage to the university's reputation. Secondly, we found that crew should not have withheld station identifiers, and by that I mean a set of information identifying the set of stations used so that their work could be precisely replicated. Third, we do not find that crew withheld certain tree data. They took steps to pass on the request to the data holders, but they should have ensured that the data was archived in a more timely way in the interest of transparency. And fourth, we looked at the much-mentioned Hide the Decline email. The WMO figure acquired iconic significance, and we find that it was misleading. We do not find that it is misleading to curtail reconstructions at some point per se, or to splice data, but we believe that both these procedures should have been made plain, ideally in the figure, but certainly clearly described in either the caption or the text. Now, finally, let me stand back a little from the immediate issues of concern and comment on some of the wider questions that working on the review has raised for me and my colleagues, and are touched on in the last pages of the executive summary. First, how is science to be conducted in a new world of openness, accountability, and indeed what I might term citizen involvement in public interest science? There need to be new ways of making results and data available, and we mentioned some aspects of current thought on that. There need to be ways of handling criticism and challenge, and of responding to a range of different sorts of criticism, and getting into a more productive relationship with critics than we've sometimes seen in this case. The science community, and I include university managers in this, need to have in the forefront of their minds the importance of the credibility of the knowledge base they're generating, and of not losing public trust in it, and their risk management in the widest sense needs to recognise this. At the same time, science needs to find ways of expressing the uncertainties that inevitably attend its findings, and mean that so much of what it does is in a sense a work in progress. More needs to be done to allow policymakers and the public to understand and work within this uncertainty. We identify the need for some sort of public space where these issues can be aired in an atmosphere that is at the same time unthreatening and properly challenging. And if the review has contributed to advancing discussion on these issues, it will be a useful contribution, I hope, in addition to addressing the questions in our remit. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mike, then Susan, other hands? Okay, then Ben.
Michael McCarthy from The Independent. In paragraph 13 of the executive summary, you say on the specific allegations made against the behaviour of CRGOED scientists, we find that their rigour and honesty as scientists are not in doubt. On paragraph 23, you say that given its the figure supplied to the WMO report was misleading by CRU scientists. Surely these two statements are self-contradictory.
Well, the ones about the science and the others that have a very particular way in which a general conclusion was presented for a different purpose. This was not a scientific paper. It wasn't a published paper, peer-reviewed with references, evidence, etc. It's that sort of work that we're talking about when we talk about the work in paragraph 13.
But what you're saying is that what was supplied to there, you couldn't describe what was supplied to the WMO as honest. Isn't that the case?
I mean, I think we took that as within this category of openness, if you like, so there being two dimensions. First of all, releasing information and data so that others can verify, check it, demonstrate it's wrong. And the second one is getting information into the public domain. I mean, the scientific domain, much of the discourse is complicated and difficult, and clearly if it's to be transmitted to the public domain so that it can be utilised by citizens to make judgments or policymakers, then it needs to be simplified. The key question is, how do you produce that simplification without, in a sense, reducing the uncertainty? One's got to make sure the uncertainty is transmitted. And I think that's the way in which we took that diagram. That diagram does not, in itself, transmit the uncertainty associated in its production. And we felt that was, we covered that under the phrase openness.
Can that have any more? No, okay. Susan?
My question is also about the finding at paragraph 23. The allegation was about intent to mislead. You find it was misleading. Did you find there was intent to mislead or not?
We didn't find that there was intent. It's very difficult to judge psychological what was going on in someone's mind, but what we do know was that for the reasons that were given, we felt that it was misleading. I don't think you would find any concrete evidence of intent. You would find lots of assertion around the debate that's been on this over the last 10 years, but I don't think you would find intent. I am going to mislead the world.
I mean, deeply buried within the WMO report, there are in fact the equivocations that are necessary for that diagram. Of course, it's deeply buried, and what we argue is that it should have been ideally contained within the diagram, so it was plainly obvious. So we think that the fact that it was said, the uncertainties that were relayed, justifies the statement that they didn't intend to mislead. But they had to be extraordinarily careful in transmitting data into the public domain to ensure that no one misunderstood what they intended.
I think there's also quite a long history to that diagram, and it grew in significance over time, I think, would be fair as well.
Okay, Ben?
Yeah, Ben works from time. I think Professor Jones told the Science and Technology Committee that he hadn't deliberately deleted any emails with an intent to prevent them from being read by critics. You say that there is evidence that emails were indeed deleted with that intent. Did you ask Jones specifically that question? What answer did he give you? And given that you've concluded that there is evidence, what does it suggest he was right?
Well, let's be very careful about what we mean by evidence here. It would not be an offence, as I understand the Information Commission's advice and the relevant acts, to delete information which might be asked for in the future but hasn't been asked for yet. It is an offence if you are asked for something and you delete it rather than give it. So first of all, you have to establish the context. And I think it will be very difficult for us to establish that context going back. What we have carefully said is that we have not seen evidence that there was deliberate deletion to avoid release. It's clear that Professor Jones did delete emails. I think it's also quite clear some of them came back again. I cannot put myself into his head at that time.
David Derbyshire.
The Mail. Given the almost inevitable criticism that we've heard about in the plot piece that you haven't addressed the key issues, it's a whitewash, that you weren't fully independent, do you feel that your conclusions have finally nailed this debate? How will you respond to those criticisms? We will get time, but this is a whitewash.
I think it's inevitable that people have made up their minds. It's certainly not a whitewash. If you look at the depth of analysis, if you look at the things we've looked at, the evidence we've collected, and the website is being put together, which will show that evidence, the responses that we got, and the references that are there to the references that are there to the backup work. Not a whitewash. We have sought to cover, as I explained, what we believe are the big issues, so that if you look at the sort of micro detail of this or that assumption about data being withheld, manipulated, mishandled, whatever, we have stepped to the big picture. And therefore we haven't ducked the issues, we've looked at them in terms of what their big outcome actually is. Now, I am not for one moment suggesting that part of the debate that we've seen, which is very much around a highly detailed, almost textual analysis, I said at the beginning that wasn't what we were about, that part of that may very well continue. But you want to hold on to the big issues. Was there something funny going on with data that people were concealing? No. We almost literally put our credit cards in the machine, got the stuff and processed it. Was there evidence that tree rings were being selected in such a way as to produce a particular set of twists in the lines? No, nobody demonstrated that. People said, if you did different things, you got different answers. But that wasn't to demonstrate that those things were better, or that it was bad science to do what was done. And if you look quite carefully at the chain of logic in Chapter 7, you'll see how that works through. So we do actually believe that we've gone to the heart and the top, if that's not a dangerously mixed metaphor, of what these issues are, to try to resolve them as best we can. But I said this is the third time I'm saying it in this answer. I don't believe that people will stop doing some of the debating that they have done. But there is one other very important point to bring out in all of this. In looking at those two points that I made about data and about the sort of tree-ring science, I think we are saying there is a way of taking this debate forward that moves on to the generation of alternative hypotheses, of testing, of checking, of replicating, and moving on, which is the classic way that science has always been done. And we are saying that can be done. It can be done because the data is there and you can work with it. You can inject your own hypotheses. And when I say that we are not commenting on the quality of the scientific judgments and outcomes, it's because I believe that part of the lesson that we've taken from this and that we're giving out is that you can do the science that way and possibly make a difference. Who knows? But the debate can go on. So that debate can go on. Doing the science differently can go on.
Okay, I have Emily, Tom Clark, Oliver Morton, David Adam and Fiona Harvey. Okay, and Richard Black and all consumers. Who was first? Emily.
Emily Beamer from the Press Association. In the broader issues, you talk about how much of the challenge for CRU's work is not always following conventional scientific method of checking and seeking to falsify conclusions or offering alternate hypotheses. Given, firstly, I was wondering if you had any particular challenges in mind when you wrote that. And on a broader point, given the influence of the blogosphere and a very different approach to the emails and to climate science that exists on the blogosphere and that has driven this whole climate-based debate, what would your recommendations to UEA and to scientists more widely be on how to engage more positively and how to tackle that particular problem?
I think I would start with don't fall into the habit of not being open, of concealing things. I would say try to find ways of engaging people who are your challengers and your critics on the ground that genuinely advances science, if you possibly can. And some of the stuff at the end there is about trying to find ways in which that might happen. And if you look at the history of all this, it's got very polarized. Mm. And you get people saying things like, we are not selling an alternative climate history. We are not trying to offer our climate history curve. One of the things that are comments in critics. So people, in fact, not setting out in some respects to do that building, replicating new hypotheses, moving on stuff. But instead making a series of critical comments. Others doing new science, new hypotheses. This is another issue about the blogosphere. Different kinds of critics making different kinds of points, not all just sniping, not all alternative science either. So a very mixed very mixed picture. But you did ask what would my advice to the people in the UEA crew position be, and it would be to try to engage. Now this has got pretty polarised over a long period, but that would be my advice. So that there's a watch out for this and don't let it happen next year for other bits of UK or indeed worldwide science. And that's why we've got on to talking a little bit about some of the things that are emerging at the moment from the American National Academy, the Shelby Amendment, the issue of the ICO and the Queen's University data. All of these things that come up at the end are current. You've got to think around how you get them into a situation where the debate can happen.
Yeah. Jim? If I could just add one more thing to that, I think what became very plain to us through the work of the review was that now more than ever, science needs to be open, and that certainly in public-funded science, researchers do not own their data. At most, they've got a brief lease on it until they release it in full publication. And it hasn't been habit in some areas of science to recognise that, and I think it's one of the broader messages that comes out that has to change.
Let me add to that, because I think the two parts of your question are really absolutely fundamental issues.
Mm.
I mean, the first one is that essentially the way in which science works is first of all by challenging hypotheses, by saying you got it wrong, and that's fine. But the other complementary part is by saying, well, actually, here is an alternative view of reality. And what has tended to happen in this domain is that it's all been about the first part, not about the second part. And if we're going to advance, then we're going to have to advance on the second, in the second domain as well. The second issue about what have we learned through all this? The Royal Society this year is celebrating its 350th anniversary. Part of what it did was to innovate a way of doing science, which is based on experiment and reason. Unfortunately, of course, over time, what's happened is that science has been contained science. It's been a group of scientists talking to each other critically, in an argumentative way, but then they've gone into the public domain and made papal pronouncements about this is this and that is that, and we expect you to accept them. Now, one of the things I think we know very well is that that's no longer acceptable, and somehow we have to move from science as a private enterprise to science as a public enterprise. And the challenge there, as we've seen here, is how do we utilise new forms of public discourse contained, let's say, within the blogosphere, and not throw the baby out with the bathwater at the same time. Some have argued that actually the blogosphere will take it all over. Well, I think the circulation of the blood, cures for particular diseases, the Fourth Road Bridge, none of those would have come out of the blogosphere. And the key question is how do we have conventional science done through classical routes, experimentally based, and the like? How do we have that interact more strongly and creatively with a larger public expression of concern over science, which is enormously important, almost universally?
Okay, Tom Clark.
Tom Clark from Channel 4 News. You say that there's a need for openness in science at the moment. While Professor Jones may have acted within the law when he released those emails, it's not very much in the spirit of scientific openness. Doesn't that suggest there is something rotten in the UEA and that we should go?
And I don't think I want to comment on the last proposition. We try to look at different things. We've tried to look at what the scientific work was, the way in which it was being handled, the way in which it was being evidenced, referenced, peer reviewed, etc., and put that in one compartment, and then see how did people behave in relation to this world that they found themselves in. And I think we are saying that the behaviour shown there didn't show a proper openness. But that doesn't make you a bad scientist, actually. And if you look at the referenced work and the way it was done, and the things that were happening about the processes, you find lots of things that pull in different directions. And you'll find quite a lot of quotes in here from emails that indicate people really tormented with the issues of getting the uncertainty right, of getting the balance of different expressions of things right. So, in fact, that's what I meant when I said in my introductory remark that these texts can pull in two ways, and just weighing them on a kind of seesaw isn't going to help us terribly much. So it's looking at the bigger picture that we've tried to get at. So I would answer your question that there is no, the fact of these things that were said about deleting stuff is not doesn't undermine the quality of the science that was being done.
Oliver Morton.
Yeah, Oliver Morton, The Economist. You say that the emails that were leaked or stolen comprise about 0.3% of what's actually on the backup servers. Your remit included looking at other emails that would help you understand the context of it, but Appendix 6 of the report seems to show that you weren't really able to look at many other emails. So I wonder what you thought that absence meant in your remit, and what conclusion do you have drawn about the principles on which this small, possibly unrepresentative subset of emails have been chosen on the larger set?
I'll ask Jim to deal with the technical stuff, but I may want to come back about a little bit to the end of your question.
Sure. There's an awful lot there. The material is held by the police because there's an ongoing police inquiry, so it was not straightforward to access it. We made considerable endeavours to do so and got access to it, and then were confronted with such a vast amount of material, not just emails of course, but huge amounts of material, which we would have had to process under very difficult conditions because of the police requirements for evidence and so on, that in the end we reached the conclusion it might be possible, would be possible, and we'd be holding this press conference probably in 6 months' time. So we'd reached the law of diminishing returns. Bear in mind, we have said we were using the emails as pointers, not as primaries. We're interested in behaviours and what people actually did, not what they said. And so that's a judgment that we reached, and it's a judgment I'd be very happy to defend.
And we did give people who wanted to make comments on the range of issues the opportunity to do so right at the beginning, and we're still within the same ambit of issues. So to that extent, if there was something sort of hiding out there and anybody had it, then we would have heard from them, we assumed.
The other point is, of course, many of the emails point in different directions. So you can make a selection from the emails to point one way, you can make a selection, and I'd highlight the email from Professor Briffer, which is in our report, where he agonises about not being pushed too far. Some would say completely the opposite. So it's not as if the emails were a chosen set which point in specifically one direction. They're not.
So that's the other part of my question. Ooh. Did you reach any conclusions about how they were chosen? I mean, they are a subset. Do you think they are a random subset? Did you reach any conclusions?
We did make some comments in Appendix 6 on that. They clearly seem to be related to particular hot events in this saga over the last 5 years. Beyond that, we really couldn't go. It's fascinating to speculate, but won't get us very far.
Okay, David Adam.
David Adam, Guardian. If the scientists' rigour and honesty is not in doubt, why were they defensive and unhelpful?
I suspect that they had got into a position where, as I think they say themselves, responses they were making were not being perhaps acknowledged or read or taken seriously, and that they felt, I've certainly heard them say this, that the same sorts of criticisms and challenges kept coming back, and I think that at a certain point the sort of attitude began to be, well, we've done all we can do, and that, of course, leads into the world of closing down, which we've seen, rather than the world of engagement, which we've all talked about this morning. So I think that's the sort of history of this and how it's developed.
Fiona Harvey.
Fiona Harvey,
Financial Post. Two questions
for you. First of all, how much did this even cost? And second, to pick up on some points that you've been made, you talked about people deciding in advance if this is the right option to them, and the way in which this debate has been conducted has been very polarised and very political. Coming from outside the world of climate science, did this surprise you? Is it that this is what you expected from a debate about such an important issue? And what do you think you would do if you were a scientist in that position?
My goodness. The answer to your first question is that the ballpark figure is £200,000. I will confess that as somebody who didn't have a background in climate science, and I think probably 6 months ago, I was heard saying that was perhaps one of the selection criteria. It was interesting and quite eyebrow-raising at times to see the quality of the discussion that was going on around the issues. Of course, one knows from looking back over the history of Kyoto and all the rest of the debates that there have been, that things were pretty polarised. If I was a climate scientist, well, from 2020 hindsight, or even I don't know what kind of hindsight you think we have, is a great thing. But I keep coming back to this notion that the lesson has to be this lesson about finding ways of having a debate that can actually build on the science, as you've heard. And you can't unwind history. I mean, there is a great history of this material, of these challenges, of these entrenched positions. I did say that I think that demonstrating that you can do quite a lot with the data and build on it and move forward, it has value. But really, it is an answer for the future that I'm giving you, which is take this as a sort of lesson in what not to let happen, and instead keep the debate going around the act of science to the greatest possible extent. I mean, whether colleagues want to add to that at all.
No, it's not just for climate science. There are other areas, key areas of science, where the public debate hasn't been carried forward at the multiple levels it's required. Sometimes there's just too much dumbing down of the debate, not enough assumption. You've got an intelligent audience out there, including on the blogosphere, not enough sharing of information. And as a result, a build-up of distrust. We saw it over GM foods. We will undoubtedly see it over synthetic biology. I think there are messages that come out of here which are much broader than climate science.
And if you look at our Chapter 5, in particular the essay by Richard Horton, you see good evidence there of the fact that highly contended science in areas which are of obvious public importance do become very passionate with very strong positions held on both sides. One only needs to look at the recent debates on MMR, the AIDS issue in Africa and the like, and indeed going back in history, it hasn't been a polite enterprise. The enterprise of science has been highly contentious, and there's been a tremendous amount of hubbub from time to time. So I don't think necessarily what we see here is very different from what has been true in the past. What is probably different is the context within which it's happening. It's a different context.
Richard Black.
Yeah, a couple. You talked about how easy it was to download the data and to construct a computer algorithm. Does that mean, in your view, we should conclude that anyone who maintains that the data is secret and that the algorithms are impossible to build, should we just conclude that they're incompetent? The second question is, some of the submissions that you received, and indeed much of the discourse around this, talked about this whole thing as having been a political act released deliberately into the public domain just before Copenhagen. I wanted to seek your view on how accurate that perception may be.
I'll take the last one first. We don't know. You will observe that we very carefully asterisked the words in the remit to avoid any implication that we had a view on what had happened. And to the best of my knowledge, police inquiries are continuing, as they say in the newspaper police reports. So I'm going to take a complete body swerve on that one. So far as whether people who have said there's something up with the data, because people won't release it, whether that's incompetence or not, I don't know. I'm going to ask Peter Clark in a moment to comment on that process. But certainly, it was a neat debating point to say, must be something wrong there, you know. And I think we have attempted to demonstrate that entry point to the debate is not a good one. You can still go in, get the data, and then say, my hypothesis is different from Crewe's hypothesis about the way in which this should be looked at and what modifications, selections, etc. you should make. But that's a different point. I'll hand over to Peter.
Yes, okay. So let's be very clear what we did. It's set out in Chapter 6 in more detail in the appendix. It became very clear very early on that anyone can go out and get hold of all of the raw temperature data very easily from a variety of sources, and we've listed some of that. In fact, it took us, I think, a few minutes to download that data, literally minutes. And what we've shown is that you can take that, you can get hold of it, that's the first thing, then you can take that and you can do exactly as has been declared by who making their food chain product. And you get the same result, and it takes, you know, a couple of days of code writing to do this. Now I think that demonstrates very clearly that nothing is hidden. Now, from that, it became very clear also that you could, as Samuel had said, then go ahead and follow your own analysis, your own hypothesis, if you wish, which could be very interesting to do. You could, for example, claim that there should be greater adjustments made to some of the stations. You could, for example, in your hypothesis, claim you should remove a large number of stations. These are all very easy things to do. It's very clear that anyone that would be competent to analyse those data would certainly have known how easy it was to obtain that. And in fact, you can find on various of the websites lists of places to go data. And it would also be very clear that anyone competent to analyse those data would realise also that they could pursue their own hypothesis very easily, and in all cases without let or hindrance from CRU. So I'm not going to go further to comment upon those that put in requests. I suspect in some cases it was people who were misled by things they had read, but I'm afraid for more you'd have to ask the people who put in the request why they were so doing.
Can I just clarify on that? Could you have done all that 5 years ago or 12 months ago? Was all the data available when these people were asking for it?
Yes, we did look into that very carefully. Yes.
No, Roger.
So it's the same question.
Yeah.
Just to clarify whether you think, in this case, some of the bloggers were malicious or mischievous in their requests.
I wouldn't want to say they were malicious or mischievous, but I said what I said to your colleague at the back. It was a very neat debating point to make.
Okay, I've got the woman here, and then I've got Oliver Morton, then I've got Ben Webster. Any other hands, because we're coming to the end? Have I missed Louise and B. Harvey? Anyone else? No, okay. Woman here, sorry.
So we have a question for yourself. We've got a case that's pretty much every single university in the UK. It's as unprepared as you get for FOI, and you take the local to the mountain.
Well, I wouldn't want to say every university, but I think there are, this is pitched on a basis, not quite there, but for the grace of God, but it's certainly pitched on a basis that there are things you better look out for. We all have jewels in the crown in our universities. Glasgow has them, Edinburgh has them, UVA has them. And very important to make sure that you're thinking about what you would do, how you make sure that they function fully and effectively, how they're properly resourced to operate well in their academic work, and at the same time to be able to cope with the kinds of challenge or contention that they might find themselves in. So I think the thesis of your question, that's a kind of modified yes.
I think also there is real work for the ICO here, and that is the Information Commissioner's Office. And that is, we are quite clear in this report that at the point at which you publish conclusions, the means by which you get to those conclusions should be transparent. However, if it takes you 20 years to publish your conclusions, should you allow results into the public domain before? There is real need for guidance here.
There's no clarification on that as yet.
As yet. I'm reasonably confident there will be. I think there's a recognition that there has to be a modus vivendi here, and there have to be some guidelines. But it's not for us. That will be for the Information Commissioner's Office.
And I think you would find that the universities collectively we'll be picking up on some of the points that are lurking in the tail end there of our broader issues and that are flagged in Chapter 10, tail end in particular, to say, look, we've just got to calibrate this in a way that works. Openness, yes. Sharing data, yes. Publicly owned data, yes. People getting on with their work and having time to do their discovering and their writing up, yes. And it's a balance.
Yeah. Oliver.
So two things on peer review. One is you look at three specific journal-related issues to peer review.
You didn't choose to look at the case where Bill Jones talked about going to town in the review of work by Lars Campbell that criticised his own work. I wonder why you've chosen not to look at that example. And the other one linked is in the IPCC, is in the submission from the IPCC. You quote in your chapter 9 the part of the IPCC where they say that McKittrick and Michaels is ceases to be statistically significant. I wondered if in your analysis of that case you formed an opinion as to whether it was proper to say something ceases to be statistically significant without showing any calculations that prove that to be the case.
I think I'll ask Jeffrey to let me come to the second one first. Now, I suspect that was an unfortunate phrase, but what is quite clear by looking at the detail, and it's all in the report and on the website, is that the argument was that the paper, the McKittrick and Michaels paper, that had argued that if you took the pattern of temperature change through time from the Crutem results, they could be equally well explained, or better explained, by a process of industrialization and urbanization of many sites that have been open country and are contained within towns as towns have grown. And they demonstrated that by making a statistical correlation. And the response of that from a number of scientists, which included Jones, was that because climate at one place is not independent of climate at another place, because there are large-scale patterns of climate change, those patterns coincide with, to a large degree, on the continental areas, many of the patterns of industrialization, then you have to take out of the analysis first the patterns of climate change, and then you can do one of the so-called p-test statistical analyses. And that, I think, is a justification for comment that it was not statistically significant. I think, the way we refer to it is to say it isn't sensible to do the p-test analysis before you've taken out of the data of the variation which comes from climate change. So that's the rationale of the argument.
Okay, Ben?
There were two parts of that.
Oh, sorry. Yes. What was the person who reminded me? Sorry,
Sam. The last Hamilton paper that Bill Jones reviewed during the IPCC.
Yes.
I'm going to go to town on this one.
Yeah. Well, I think we found that we couldn't get enough evidence to resolve what that might mean.
Ben?
Yeah, I'll say, well, I don't think I've got an answer. Did you ask Jones if he had deliberately deleted emails to avoid disclosure?
No.
No. Why not?
We worked from the basis of the material that was there. And bear in mind, what we were conducting was not some kind of police inquiry. We were not interviewing someone under caution. And so I would prefer to have worked from the facts we could establish rather than from assertions.
Well, you could have established facts from him. I mean, the allegation has been made as whitewashing. You made a report passing judgment. There appears to be evidence he must be. You had the opportunity, because I think you can remind us how many times you spoke to him. You didn't ask him that question.
Not that specific question.
Louise Gray.
On the WMO, can you just tell us a little bit more? I'm afraid to say it's not the hockey stick graph, but you just tell us what it shows and what effect that might have had, the fact that that wasn't the latest and wasn't the meaning. And also, what do you want to happen next in terms of the investigation and the SRI? Because there were suggestions that perhaps the law should be changed.
So these are two. Two quite separate points. The WMO graph was a graph on the cover of a report. I guess it has a hockey stick shape ish, used to illustrate, to paint a picture and catch the eye. It became increasingly significant because folks started using it as they had used the hockey stick graph.
And over what period did it show?
Well, it started in 1990. I think
I mean, perhaps to explain that plot, because there's probably a lot of misunderstanding. Mm. So the plot shows three lines taken from Proxy Gate. And then in the later years, there are data from instrument temperature. Now, of those three lines from Proxy Gate, that's three lines. For those three lines, one of those exhibited a thing that's known as divergence, a word that comes up a lot in this. And this is where reconstruction of temperature from the proxy diverges from the known temperature coming from instruments where they exist. Now, we don't have the time here to go into the continuing quest to understand that. It's written in a report, there's lots of papers about it, but examples are the belief that it could be we're standardizing and we're processing those. But anyway, these are the things we have. Now, what was done on that plot was firstly the line that showed after, I think it was about the year 1560, the diverging data. That diverging data was simply removed from the line to avoid the plot showing three proxy lines going along, then one going down, and the instrument temperature going up. Now let's be clear, if you had left that line in going down, it wouldn't have meant that temperature's be falling, it just means that that data isn't tracking temperature. So it was removed for reasons of clarity or whatever. The second thing that was done is to splice the proxy data onto the instrument data in a very clean way. Now, these things are perfectly okay to do, providing you explain them. There's nothing illegal about doing any of those things. And indeed, the caption did say that this contains proxy data and after 1850 temperature data. But our conclusion is that that should have been made much clearer, either in the plot or certainly in the text, to say what was done and what was not said.
Do you have a copy of that graph?
I don't think we did not include one in this, but it's on the website.
It's not on the website, this copy.
And the graph from
1850
is not right?
Say again.
From 1850
to
present day?
Yes. It's not. Well, actually, I think you have to ask people that use the term hockey stick. My interpretation is hockey stick was first coined in relation to the plots produced by a man, and those are proxy reconstructions only, and that was way back in 98. Proxy reconstructions, not have to do it, well, you can see proxy reconstructions go up in later years. But also, independently of that temperature, instrument temperature, not only got in later years, whether those out there wish to use hockey stick for both of those, they are completely independent pieces of information.
What are the other two proxies on the graph? Sorry.
Yeah,
sorry. The other two proxies, one is tree rings.
Actually, I forgot, they're all tree rings. What I cannot remember is if whether others of them also included other proxy data. We can check that. So some of these lines are from composite. Yeah.
We're going to have to speed things up a bit here. I've got two final questions and then we have to call. One is...
Can I just come back on Ben?
Yes.
Ben, just to come back on that answer. As you'll find in paragraph 28 of chapter 10, the reason we didn't ask him that specific question is we had an email that says, about 2 months ago, I deleted loads of emails, so have little, if anything, at all. So there seemed no point in repeating the question.
So that doesn't. Yeah. B. Harvey and David Derbyshire, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to bring it to a close. B.
Thanks very much. What are your recommendations to there should be a public space or some sort of provided in which these issues can be aired and revealed? Like those of us in mainstream media, we thought that actually our goal is to provide that kind of public space. Can I ask what do you think of the way media has handled climate change science in the last 6 months, and do you think that we have provided a public space where our healthy debate on these issues can flourish?
Oh, this is where it all goes wrong. Say nice things about it.
No.
I think that the first nice thing to say is that the media has given it a lot of space, and that's a good thing. It has brought the issues to prominence, and it's in some senses, focused them quite well. You'll see from this report that we have tried to develop that focus into saying what are the real things. And I hope that that will be seen by you guys as helpful in terms of using your public space to good effect and commenting on that, on that, that focus. What I don't think we've yet got is the kind of ability to have the unthreatened, mature, yet challenging, all those nice words I used at the beginning, sort of dialogue in a media space like this. You know, it's difficult to get it beyond, relatively speaking, quick hits. not sound bites, you're all better than that, but you know, to get it into a really grown up debate in the context that the media provides. So I would say yes to what you've done, listen to what we've said and think about it. But by public space we meant more than that. We did mean some kind of structured kind of debate, which where we are now can contribute to, as can learned societies, as can research funders. It's that kind of area as well as the media.
Can I just comment? I mean, I think scientists and the media have the same challenge, and that is how to take complicated ideas expressed in peculiar papers with lots of mathematics and translate that into simple, comprehensible terms in ways that don't do violence to the underlying science. But having said that, we both have different competencies. You know, like we understand the underlying science, but are not so good in translating it into simple terms that are comprehensible. And equally, you're much better at forging those terms, but find it much more difficult to dip into the science. And I think, I don't know how one might do this, but some way of, if you like, connecting those two sides of the bridge together seems to me to be very important. But then, of course, the third element is our fellow citizens who are not professional scientists, not professional journalists, but who want, and quite rightly want, to get involved in the debate.
David Darbyshire, last question.
Yeah, just to ask Professor Clark, can you just clarify, when you did the reconstruction of the data series and found it was relatively simple to do, can you just tell me sort of the dates of that series? Was that just instrument data?
Yeah, correct.
So from 1850 to...
Correct. This is chapter 6, and it's the instrument data from 1850 up to whenever the last station is, 2005, 2006.
Okay, and is this exactly the information that was the subject of these FOI requests that CRU scientists were kind of reluctant to submit it together?
So I'm going to all intents and purposes, yes, but I'll clarify what I mean by that. The data is in global repositories. It comes from real sources, national meteorological offices. So in principle, you can go to all of those and get the data that you wish. As we say, actually, the process of doing that would be rather hard. And the other subtlety is the data evolves slightly. National offices will have data. They'll find fault. They'll change it a bit here or there. So to say that the data in these repositories is exactly the same to the very last digit in every entry, I think that's probably not the case. But it makes no material effect to the analysis.
And that might seem surprising to people who are following this, given that the ASIC committee, the select committee, spent a long time banging on about trying to get to the bottom of why this data wasn't available and why it wasn't being released and the copyright issue.
I think there's probably been a confusion in people's minds between data and metadata. This is a term we love. It's like metadata, description of data, and we have said that they were less than helpful in releasing the information that will allow you to go out and source the exact identical stations that they had used in their analysis. So that's metadata. And I think there was conflation.
Okay. I'm going to bring it to a close. Just a couple of things. Number one, to remind you that Richard Horton is here, who's the editor of The Lancet. So if anyone wants to go to the murky, dark corners of how peer review is, please go and talk to him. Also, very importantly, this woman here, Helen Davison, is the press officer for the review team and is organising all the media bids. So if any of you want to talk to any of these guys after this briefing, you have to go through her and take your time slot and behave yourselves and be patient, because there's a lot of you want to. We're going to have literally 3 or 4 minutes for people who need to leave or do broadcast interviews to do so, or quick toilet break or whatever, and then we'll be back here with UEA for their response.